Good morning, everybody. First of all, I'd like to say my name's Dave. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I'm serving through the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that, I'm truly grateful. And I want to thank the committee for inviting us here. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm willing to go anywhere and everywhere for Alcoholics Anonymous because this fellowship saved my life, gave me a life, and gave me a family, as you just heard. You know, but I just want to take a moment to thank the committee for allowing us the hospitality to come here. You know, I love the Northeast because it's always cold here. Yeah. We don't get much snow where we live, you know, and I get to see old friends like Woody that I've seen for years. Watched him in all kinds of business meetings argue with people, you know, you never forget Woody, you know. But, you know, I am truly grateful and blessed to be here. You know, you've heard a lot about me through my other half. And, you know, when I stumbled upon this young lady in 11th grade, she was my diamond in the rough. You know, it just needed polishing, and she helped me polish it. You know, and I never want to forget that because what she said was the truth, and I don't deny any of it, you know. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, I can stand here before you and say that what she shared was the honest truth. You know, if you want to know my story, you need to hear hers first, you know, because she'll tell you the parts I might want to leave out, you know. But the truth of it is, you know, alcoholism has been in my family since the day I was born. My dad and his family, they were functional alcoholics, you know, construction workers, you know, worked hard. Drank every weekend, you know, and didn't like a lot of it going on in the household, but I had no choice. You take what you get. You know, I come from a family of nine, five sisters, one other brother, and a mother and father. A loving family. You know, the one thing we had, we may not have had money, but we had a lot of love. And they made sure you knew it every night before you went to bed. You had to hug every one of your sisters and brothers and tell them that you loved them. I hated it, you know, right from the beginning, you know. You know, my life growing up was like I spent most of my time with my dad, you know, fishing. And from the early on, I had things happen in my life outside of my home that made me real angry with life. And I kind of withdrew from life at about 7.5, 8 years old. You know, I didn't like people, period, not even my own family, you know, from things that had taken place in my life. And I know today that that's something happened. It's not the person that who I am today, you know. Like, I resented people. I resented everything, you know. And I went through life with a chip on my shoulder early on in life. Like, how could God let things happen like that to me, you know. And like, so I lost a God real early on in my life, you know. And the bottom line is that as much love as my family wanted to give me, I could not accept it, you know. And so I went through my early childhood just evading everything and everybody, never wanting to be close to anybody because, like, if you knew what the things that had happened, you wouldn't want to know me, you know. And, like, the bottom line is that I'm not responsible for other people's actions, but, you know, I felt like I was responsible for the whole weight of the world on my shoulders. And so I just had a major resentment. I didn't even know that word back then, but I had a major resentment from, like, the age of 8 on, you know, and always thinking that I would get even, you know. And I'm glad I found a drink first, you know. At the age of 13, I found a drink hanging around with the fellas on the corner playing basketball. And we used to buy a couple quarts of Boone's Farm wine. And, you know, it just looked like something I needed to do to fit in. Because up to that point in my life, the only person I fit in was with me. And that's pretty bad company when everybody around you in a city block and you get along with nobody, you know. But I wound up hanging out with these guys, you know, and we started drinking Boone's Farm. And we love hot rods, we love nice women, and we love to just raise hell and have fun, you know. And it just seemed like something I wanted to do because it took me away from what everything I knew at that point in my life. And so at 13, I started hanging around the stable. They had horses around there, and they built hot rods on the other side of the stable. And, like, I said, I could do this for the rest of my life, you know. I don't know what I was doing, but, you know, just getting drunk, you know, and looking up at the horses and the race cars, watching, maybe I'll become a race car driver or something, you know. Had no real ambition in life, period, you know. But my dad was one of these guys that wanted you to work hard even though you didn't want to work hard, you know. So I was this go-get-it boy until I got of age not to go get it, you know. And he taught me a lot of principles about working and working hard, you know, and I just didn't want to do the type of work he did, you know. So I would disappear early on in the morning, you know, before he came to, I was gone, you know, because I got tired of pushing wheelbarrows at 11 and 12 years old, you know, I just thought this was not a job for a kid like me, you know. And he thought it was a great job for a kid like me, you know, cheap labor, you know. But the bottom line is that it was unconditional love, and he wanted to just keep me out of trouble. Because I grew up in an era where there was a lot of gang fighting going on. It was the end of the Vietnam War, and everybody was doing everything and just celebrating. And he just wanted me to be safe at all times. And the bottom line is that I was a kid, 13 years old, walking around, couldn't figure out what I wanted to do in life. And figuring out why God had treated me so bad so early on in life. And like, I asked my mom one Sunday, I said, do I have to go to Sunday school anymore? She said, that's your choice. I said, I choose not to, you know, because I figured, why should I go worship something that he ain't looking out for me? You know, I knew it right off that he didn't have a plan for me to put me where I was at a young age like that, you know. And like, the bottom line, I had major resentments against God and everybody else, you know. And like, the bottom line is that I found Boone's Farm, and I found 18 friends. And these 18 friends would become the guys that I would go to, would die with, you know, and so I thought. And but it was, they didn't care who you were, what you did, or what had happened to you. As long as you had 75 cents, it didn't matter who you were, what you were. It just didn't matter. And, you know, I felt most comfortable around a barrel of fire and a bottle of booze. Because nobody qualified around a bottle of booze. As long as you didn't guzzle or burp in the bottle, you're okay. You know, because they watch for that, you know. And I learned early on that if you want yours, get it while it's going, because it ain't coming back, you know. I learned that about drinking real early, you know. And, like, and you know, I thought there was nothing wrong with that, you know. And, like, throughout high school, you know, I tried to be the best person I could be, because that's what my parents taught me to be, you know. But on the weekends and after school, I love getting high, you know, and basically whatever it took to do that, I would do that, you know. And like, I wasn't a bad guy. I hated fighting. I hated gangs, you know. And I had a large family in Philadelphia that belonged to a lot of different gangs that had been shot, paralyzed, and all that type of thing. So everywhere I went, they just beat me up and send me home. So, you know, I caught a bad break early on in life, you know. Well, that's such and such's cousin. Let's beat him up and send him home, you know. And like, I got beaten just for being somebody else, you know. And so there was really nothing to look forward to in life. And I mean, at that time, we had a real tough cop squad in Philadelphia at that point in time. It was the Rizzo area. And like, the cops were notorious for just beating kids up and stuff like that, you know. And like, you can't be protected by the cops. You're getting beat up by the gangs. Other people are bothering you. Why live, you know? And like, so why not just stay drunk and forget everything, you know? And that's basically what I thought. You know, when I get out of here, I'm getting out of here. I'm moving as far away from Philadelphia as I can. But I never moved anywhere. That was all in my mind, you know. The things I thought between my two ears were magnificent. But they never happened, you know. In high school, I got good grades in high school, you know. And in my 11th year, I asked my wife Denise to go on the prom with me. And I was actually going out with my best friend's sister, and she had an attitude, so I asked Denise to go on the prom with me. It seemed like a good thing to do, you know. Why deal with an attitude when I could just go to the prom, you know? I just wasn't willing to deal with people's attitudes at that point in time, you know. But, you know, and like she said, I drove a 1963 Dodge with no mufflers and headers on it, and, you know, would wake up the whole block, you know, park in the middle of the block, create a disturbance, take off again, you know, until I met her dad, you know. He was this real tall fella, you know, and like, I'm kind of a short guy, you know, and like, he looked just pretty stern. So I tried to be somewhat decent around him, but after 9 o'clock, all bets was off. Because once I had a few bottles of booze in me, I didn't care how tall you were, how big you were, you know. I was out on a mission to destroy myself and anything else in my path, you know. And like, I used to think about that at night, you know, like, how did I get here? I don't want to be a drunk like the rest of my family. And then like, I had a lot of unhappiness within my own self, you know. And like, the bottom line, I was my own worst problem, you know. So we hung around. We did a lot of great things. We went to Atlantic City. We partied with some high school friends, you know. And I taught her how to drive, so I wouldn't have to drive drunk. So that was a plus in that whole relationship, you know. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, so that was more for me, you know. So that was a whole deal for me, you know. And to be honest, you know, like, her life was totally different from mine. I'll tell you that. You know, like in my house, you know, with seven kids, you know, it was tough. And my dad didn't work all the time because of rain or whatever. You know, we had, like, in our china closet, we had the Welch's jelly jar characters. In her china closet, they had stuff with gold rims. You know, I was fascinated when I went there. You know, like, and we only grew up a block from each other. She grew up on this end, and I grew up on the other end of another block right next to each other. And, you know, like, and even from a young kid, you know, I knew her, and like, but would never say anything to her, you know, until that night I asked her to go on a prom with me. And that's when the first night she asked for trouble, you know. She bought trouble that night, you know, because you know what we do when we go to prom? We get drunk and have fun, you know, and that's what I proceeded to do. But I think I was somewhat of a gentleman that night, you know. But I could see, you know, she used to put on her little majorette outfit. They, great, you know what I mean? Back then, you know, I never participated in sports, but I would always go watch the majorettes and the cheerleaders, you know what I mean? I was a real supporter, you know. in my neighborhood, you really didn't play sports because if you played it in the playground, if you tackled somebody too hard, they'd pull an axe out on you. So I realized I didn't want to play football, you know what I mean? I tried to play basketball, and you just get beat up playing basketball. I was too short to, you know. So the only thing it was for me to do was build hot rods and act like a nut, you know. And, like, that fit in real good because nobody really cared, you know. But life went on, you know. We started hanging out, dating, and I asked her to marry me at 21. And also at 21, I was working in a hospital called Fitzgerald Mercy Hospital from 4 a.m. to 1 a.m. A great alcoholic's hours, you know, because you get off at 1 p.m. and you can drink till 9, go to bed till 3, and go back to work. Nobody notices anything, so why would she see me? You know, when she was working, I was drunk. When she was home, I was asleep. And when she was up, I was gone again. You know, it worked out perfect, you know. And the nuns used to tell me at the hospital, you know, they said, God's really got a plan for you. And I'm thinking, yeah, he's already given me a plan in life. I don't want the next one. You know, but the truth of it is I had no idea what I wanted. And I got a phone call one day from a friend of mine, asked me if I wanted a real job. And I said, I got a job. Yeah. He says, I mean a real job, working for a real company. And I said, sure. And so I applied, put an application in for this oil company. And like... about 6 months later, they called me, and I was in a drunken stupor. And the lady says, this is such and such oil company. And I said, well, I don't need any oil today, honey. It was like 100 degrees outside. What do I need with oil? She said, no, we finally got your application. We want to know if you would like to come work for us. And I just stood up, you know, because... I don't know. I just knew something else had taken place, and I thanked the nuns for that. I really did. You know, I didn't believe in God, but I thanked the nuns for it. The ones I used to see at 4 o'clock in the morning getting beat up by a buffer, and they would say, Sonny, you all right? And the buffer would have me all up in the corner, you know? I think they knew what was going on, too, but I never let on that I had a problem, you know? And the bottom line is that those nuns used to pray for me every day because, like, some days I couldn't get out of my own way, you know? I'd be wrapped up in extension cords. Like, I hope nobody's awake, you know? But the bottom line is that, you know, there were a lot of people praying for a guy like me, and I didn't even know it, you know? I had a lot of good friends that just wanted me to stay out of trouble, not get locked up, not wind up in a penitentiary like a lot of my other friends did, you know, and like I managed to do that, you know. Occasionally I had some overnight stays, you know, not that I wanted to, but they offered me unconditional terms, you know, you either stay here or you go somewhere else, you know, and like I was okay with things like that, but you know, my family, they loved me unconditionally, even though I couldn't love them at that point in my life, and I don't know. Life took on a new meaning when I got that new job. The only thing happened is that I went from Boone's Farm and Tiger Roost to Tanqueray, you know, and other substances, I say in passing, you know. And like, I think I just got drunker fast and I got sicker quicker, which brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous a lot quicker. And I like to say that, you know, because I don't like to spend a whole lot of time on my drunk a lot because that's not the solution for a guy like me. The solution was realizing that day she walked out on Sunday that, for almost 17 years, I had watched a person destroy themselves from within. And I knew when she walked out that she was not the person that she was that I had married, you know, and like I knew something was wrong. I think we all come to that jumping off point to where we know that, you know, what used to be so bright and cheerful now was gray. And when she walked out that Sunday, I knew something had taken place, and I knew I was responsible for a lot of it. And it wasn't like when she walked out the door in the rain that I went to get her, because I had no skills how to deal with something like that, so I just let her go. You know, I figured she'd be better off. You know, there's a lot of things I thought like that. I can remember driving across the Strawberry Mansion Bridge and getting to the bridge in Fairmount Park. And the bridge I used to go get drunk under a lot, you know, and I was thinking, well, if I just jump off here, she won't have anything else to worry about. I drove up there one night, two sheets to the wind, and I got out, I started walking, and I had a moment of clarity. I can't swim. So I got back in the car and went home. You know, I wanted help but didn't know how to ask for help. And that Sunday morning I woke up, I told her I was going to call a supervisor of mine that had a problem with other substance, drugs and alcohol. And he'd become a refined, born-again Christian. And he was always in my corner at work. And he said, if you ever need help, you call me no matter what time of day. And I knew that I could look this guy straight in the eye and I could call him. I called him. He said, first thing he asked me, are you drinking? No. I got a glass in my hand, but I'm saying no. He said, can you get to my house? I said, sure. And I got to his house in Gibbstown, New Jersey, and it's right around the corner from my job. And he says, I'm going to introduce you to a group of people that's going to change your way of life. And I said, a group of people. I thought you were just going to do this. We get in his car, and we're driving down these back roads, no lights, no nothing. We pull into this octagon-looking church. And I'm like, ooh, this don't even look good. You know, there's no lights outside the church. What kind of group of people am I going to meet? You know, so we go into church, and I'm in total fear right now. You know what I mean? Sort of like right now. I'm the only black guy in a place where there's a lot of white guys and white women. But the funny part is everybody's dressed from sheets from the neck down. And I'm like, whoa, something's wrong here. You know, and he says, don't panic. He says, this is just a baptismal. I said, I can't do that. I said, I'll burn in hell if they try to baptize me. And that picture, if you could just picture that in your mind, I was shaking with fear, and he knew it, you know, it was worse than when I needed a drink. And I sat there, and he says, when they get done, they'll talk to you next. And he brought all these people over, they were singing and praising the Lord, and I'm like, oh no, you know, I don't want any parts of this praising the Lord thing. And you know, they came over and prayed for me and settled me down, and they got my confidence. They got my confidence in less than an hour and a half, and they told me that I could be just like them if I did exactly what they did. And they said, did they turn their life and will over the care of Jesus Christ? And I said, oh, no. Not doing that, you know. But I sat there, and they convinced me that if I was going to get help, I needed to get help through the Lord. And my mind kept saying, well, God knew this, God did that. It didn't compute, you know. And the bottom line is that I left that church with a feeling that maybe for once in my life I could get help. I got to the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, and my alcoholic mind says, well, if we're going out this way, we might as well have one good night. And I was drunk again, you know, and I thought God's message really didn't work. It lasted as long as I was under his roof. And I woke up that next morning, as only alcoholics know, with four horsemen, bewilderment, terror, frustration, and fear. And, you know, I was sick and tired of being sick. And I turned myself into the employee relations office. And he told me that night, he said, tonight is between you and my friends. He said, tomorrow is between you and the company. So if you happen to choose that route, he says, I will support you all the way, but I will never say what happened here tonight. You know, and he's been true to that word ever since. You know, and I'd like to thank that guy for that. You know, they sent me to a place called Chit Chat, a Karen Foundation place. And I said, what's a chit chat? And I said, what do you do there? They said, you go and chat. I said, what am I going to chat about? They said, your alcoholism and your drug addiction. I said, I don't have that problem. The lady says, I think you got more than that problem, but you can start off with just those two things. You know? And like she said, my mother, my wife, and a couple of my sisters took me to this institution, and they dropped me off, and you know the counselor says, well, who is it? I looked at them and they were all looking at me, you know, and like they just disappeared. And, you know, it was like the longest ride of my life that day. I passed the nuclear silos, all these cornfields. I said, this must be the end, you know. Like, and, you know, I had bought this beautiful little sports car. I mean, a Toyota Celica with a two-seater with four people in the family. So, yeah, I really wasn't thinking about family. And it was a stick shift, and she really didn't know how to drive it, but she showed me she could drive it, leaving that parking lot, you know. I heard gears for like 2 miles and just scraped it. I think that was a little bit of anger, to be honest with you, know. But, you know, I stayed there for 28 days, and I learned the nature of my disease. And there they taught me that an alcoholic like me doesn't stand a chance unless I find a new way of life, or I use the 12 steps in my life. And I know for two weeks I was fighting them tooth and nail that, you know, maybe it was just a little bad luck, like character Linus with the blanket with the cloud over his head. I thought I just had that for 17 years, but it would change, you know, and they told me it wouldn't. And the lady said to me, she looked at me, eyeball to eyeball, she said, a drunk like you probably going to die in the street if you don't find our way of life. And like, I saw that in her eyes, you know. And like, for some reason, next morning I woke up, I was willing. And we had this little circle thing where you sit in a circle. So they asked me to sit in a circle. And I was like, because I wasn't a willing participant up to this point. And this little young lady, about 2'2", stood up. And she says, are you a movie star? I said, nope. Are you a sports figure? I said, I'd like to be. She says, are you a drunk? I said, not too sure. She said, well, get the hell out of here then. I mean, like, and I think that was God's breaking the wall down, because it embarrassed me in front of that group of community of 60. And I said, well, the only reason I'm here is because I think I got a problem with alcohol, but I don't know what to do about it. And that was the start of me surrendering to this disease. And they all clapped and stood up like something had happened, you know. Like, and they told me to go sit back outside the circle now. You know, I could finally be a part of them. And I became a model patient for the next 2 weeks. And, you know, I left that rehab with all the intentions of never surrendering to this disease again. And I left there on May 15th of 1986. I came home on my wife's birthday. That's what I gave her, a birthday present, coming home on her birthday. You know, somewhat half silly. And I came home with a lot of fear. As she told you, she was marking the calendar. And I came home and I was scared, a lot of fear. And I got into the house, and it was funny because she had got so angry, so she just let everything go the way it was supposed to go so I could get my attention. And I sat down, I turned the TV off, and they went back off. I was like, wow, it must be unplugged. She said, well, if you paid the bill, you probably could turn it on, you know. Here was the sarcasm side coming out of her, you know. And like, and I remember thinking all kind of ways I could beat the electric company, you know. And then I'm thinking, now I guess I got to go make arrangements to have electric. And then the gas company showed up, and it was like one company after another. And I met this old wise character in AA. He says, you know, utilities have programs, and if you follow the steps, they too will be more revealing to you. So the next morning I went up, made amends to the electric company and the gas company. I figured, well, it's spring now, and I can hold off to at least September. I'm still thinking like an alcoholic, but I belong to a group called the West Oak Lane Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is up in the West Oak Lane area of Philadelphia. And there they taught me how to recover using the 12 steps. They took all the but, woulds, and coulds out of my vocabularies. They told me that I would sit here, and I would sit here for 6 months, and I would not say a word. And when they called on me, just say my name just to let everybody know I was still here. And you know, as much as I hated it because I thought I had something to offer, I didn't say anything. I became a sponge and I absorbed, and I watched these people. I became part of setting up the chairs, making the coffee and stuff like that. I was willing to do anything besides go home at night because I knew she was pissed off, you know. So if the meeting would have went to 6 o'clock, I went straight to work from there, you know. I was just still running, you know. And the bottom line is that those people loved me unconditionally till I could love myself. And after 6 months, they asked me to say something. I had nothing to say. You know, I don't get it. You know, they make you shut up for 6 months, and then you don't have anything to say when it's time to say something. You know, and like, I had my first 12-step call after 6 months, and the guy says, "You tell exactly what you know." And I said, "What's that?" He says, "Nothing, just your name." And I said, "I can do that, you know." He said, "Because this is a personal friend of mine's daughter, and I don't want you to screw this up. So just tell her your name and tell her that you're happy to be here." And I told her that, and then off we went to a rehab. And he said, "That was a successful job. Neither one of us got drunk. I'm not going to worry too much about her right now, but we didn't get drunk." And like I said, "Wow, that's how it works? I can do this." And the bottom line is, those were the early days where, you know, I did what they told me to do. I stopped fighting. I ceased fighting everything and everybody, like it says in Step 10. I started to become willing to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous started to infiltrate my life to where I started to have a design for living. I started to want to help others. I started being more considerate of others and less considerate of myself. You know, I started to see new hope beyond the light. You know, and like I started to dream greater dreams, and it was just waking up without a drink. For me, early on, my first year, just waking up without a drink was like, I'll tell you what, when that 6 month went past, you know, like I was happy. And I thought the group should be happy. And they said, "Well, you've been doing it for 6 months. What's so different about the day?" Like, really busted my bubble, you know, because I thought they was going to give me some accolade for being sober for 6 months. They said, "That lady been over here sober for 52 years. What's your problem?" You know, keep coming back, kid. That's what they called me, a kid at that point, you know. And like, the bottom line is that I've gotten what I, in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I could have never got anywhere else. I've been restored to sanity. In step two is where I took all the bull out of my life and I dealt with just principles. In step three, you asked me to surrender my life and will over to the care of God on a daily basis. And I do that on a daily basis because I know it works. In spite of what I think about God, I know it works. In step four, I found that in step four, taking my moral inventory, that it was me, it wasn't God. You know, I've been blaming people for everything in my life. And I finally realized that God doesn't let things happen to people. People have make things happen to people. And so I was able to let go of my resentment to the God of my understanding at that point in time. And that bottom line of the fourth step carried me into a whole new adventure. You know, and the fifth step, I shared it with my sponsor. He was at that time almost legally blind, so I printed real, real small. I forgot they got copies that can blow it up. Because I didn't want him to know what was in my fourth step. And he blew it up, sent it back to me, says, "I think you need to redo this." He says, "Forget about all the good things that happened in your life. Tell me what you did to other people." And for once, he made me look at me. It wasn't about what everybody else had done to me. You know, and like, and when my pen started to write, I started to feel. And I started to feel a lot better than I ever felt in my life. And I remember being at work writing this fourth step. And things just changed that next day because I was willing to share that with him, eyeball to eyeball. And he looked at me, he says, "I think something has changed and I think you better hold on to it." And he told me, he says, "Dave, for a guy like you, it doesn't get any better than this." I said, "Just going to meetings?" He says, "I think you missed a ticket here, fella." And so from that day to this day, I still take a daily inventory of myself. But what has helped me is steps 4 through 11. You know, because I still have an amends list. I still have a list of people that I still need to make amends to. I've made a lot of physical amends to my employer, my wife, my kids, my mother, you know. But there are people out there I still need to make amends to. And I'm willing, like it says in the sixth and seventh step, I'm willing to do that whenever God permits that, you know. And one thing that I do is, like, I stay involved and I stay active so I don't forget where I came from. Because the key to my life existence is service. You know, I don't know about you, but if I'm not doing anything, I start doing me. That's not a good deal, you know. But whenever I'm involved in service, it seems like the higher power takes over my life. And I can actually call him God today. He takes over in my life, and he takes me to different levels of where I've never been before. It may be the same day. Nothing different may happen, but I feel different on the inside. And I finally understood what this one old-timer was saying the first couple Saturdays I met at AA. He says, "Son, what do you got going for yourself on the inside?" And I said, "Well, my wife, you know, because at that time she was my guy, and I understand that this is an inside job. It's had nothing to do with anything I'm ever going to do exterior to my life. It's about how I feel and where I am, you know, and today it's all about the inside job for me. You know, I can gain a lot of things in life, but if I don't have peace from within, I have nothing. And that's one of the things I've been searching for all my life, is to be peaceful from within. You know, before I came to you, I hated walking in my own skin. Today, it fits quite right. A little tough and a little wide, but, you know, it's quite right. You know, and that's all because I've accepted my devastating weakness and my handicaps, you know. I've been able to be reborn into the fourth dimension of this program. I've been able to walk and look through a new pair of glasses, you know. And when I realized that where a drunk like me came from May 18th, 1986, you know, how do I get there from here? That's to the love of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding. And that the wonderful fellowship called Al-Anon, you know, that's how I got here. There's no real secret. I just had to follow the 12 steps in this program, you know. And the traditions allowed me to become one among many. So it doesn't matter if I look different, as long as I feel the same, I'm okay with me. You know, and I've been able to take that through life in every area I go in my life, you know. A lot of times, like being sober, you know, I have a lot of opposition to people that are just normal, you know. And I look at that same principle, that I'm just one among many. So a lot of times I don't have to tell you that I'm different. I just feel the same and I go on with life, you know, because it's about what I feel that keeps me going. You know, it's not about my differences, you know. I had a friend of mine early on in life told me, she said, whenever you look across the table and if you see anything different besides an alcoholic, you're in the wrong place. And I said, what do you mean? She says, we don't have any color boundaries. She said, we have alcoholics. We have people with other problems. But if you find yourself different, maybe you're in the wrong place. I haven't found myself different yet, you know. And I'd like to thank that to the God of my understanding, who I choose to call God today, because he's done for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. He's given me a family. He's given me hope. When my wife was sick with our daughter, like, I was not happy. How can you be happy and drunk and high all the time? You know, I was searching for something. I was searching for happiness in every area of my life, and never found anything. I found a lot of people that I bought along the way. And I'll tell you, I've been sober almost 22 years. Next week it'll be 22 years. And I've had two friends out of 18 that I grew up with called me in 22 years. I had a lot of friends. So I thought. And the reason that most of them won't call me, because most of them are in the penitentiary dead. Because their last drink was alcohol. You know, I'm a living example that you don't have to die from alcohol, even if it tells you you do. I follow the 12 steps every day of my life, you know, the best of my ability, not to my sponsors, because I can't even live up to his shoes. You know, and I'm not even going to try, because it's like a 6'9" deal and I can't make it, you know. I got a long way to reach you, but what I have in the inside will compare with any alcoholic on this earth. I have the experience of my higher power. I have the experience of hope. You know, I have experience of life today. You know, when I woke up this morning, you know, I would have rather been in Tom's shoes, done. You know, but I'm in my own shoes, you know. And like, I was only given a gift to carry the message. And I went to this workshop called Carry the Message and Not the Mess. I totally believe in that, you know. Like, I'll help you do anything, anytime, but I will not carry your mess for you. Because I think we have to separate our own mess from our own self. That's the way we get help, and we find out who we are and what we are. And through the 12 steps, I've been able to find out that, you know, like, I had a desire to drink, but I have a desire to work with others more than I have a desire not to drink. And that desire to work with others carries me to a lot of different places. From Yale to jail, I get to visit more jails than the overnight stays that I stayed, you know. And it's okay, because when I walk out, you know, like, I feel real good, you know. Not that they feel any different, but I got some freedom here today, folks. I have freedom that carries me beyond my wildest dreams. When I look at my two kids today, like, I just say, but for the grace of God. That loving daughter that I really wasn't a part of my family at that time, she's wrapped around this pinky of mine. Probably got half my arm, you know. She says, I want, I say, I will, you know. So whoever marries her, they got a tough deal to go through, you know what I mean? My son, God bless him, he's an angel. I have been truly blessed. I have two beautiful kids. I have a son that's almost 30, and he drinks, but not like I do. He remembers that, well, Dad needs this, and he does it. If you'd have told me to do something at 30, I couldn't do it, did anything for you. And we have a loving relationship, so we build hot rods and custom trucks together. And we can go places. He said, isn't this out of your league? He said, but come on anyway. You know, and like that, I'm able to join in with his friends, and they look at me and say, "Mr. Madison, well, if the music's too loud, tell us to turn it." I say, "Have fun, man. I know what it's like to be in your 20s. Don't stop because I'm sitting here. You know, I'm able to blend in anywhere and everywhere. Today, I'm not that elephant they talk about in the room, you know. I'm a guy with a loving heart, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous giving me what I could not give myself. And it's only through the grace of God that I've been able to come to this point in my life and know that, you know, there is a God of my understanding. And I want to thank all of you for being here, you know, how do I get here from there? And I'm going to tell you once again, it's through a loving God. Thanks.